Welcome to Skin Deep. I'm Dr. Anna Chacon, and today we have a very special guest joining us. Get ready for some expert insights you won't want to miss. Let's dive right in.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how's it going?
Good, apologize for the slight delay.
Okay, no problem. No, it's very low-key. This is the first day that we are doing this. This is my new podcast. Nice to meet you, Anna. And a Chicago psychologist.
Nice to meet you as well. Joycey, are you in somewhere that's snowing, or is that just a fun background?
Yeah, I'm in Miami, Florida.
Big snow.
Yeah, let me just take it off so you can see. Yeah, so that's where I am, the palm trees in the back. But I just like it because it's just kind of cozy. I actually use it with my patients too. It just kind of puts, I've gotten lots of compliments on the background. It just kind of makes people at home. It's almost like your living room in a cabin, basically a cabin up north. But I also do, I'm always attracted, I guess, to what I didn't have. I was raised in Florida, you know, didn't see snow until much later. And then I also work part-time on a contract basis in Alaska. So I'm attracted to stuff I just didn't have or don't see a lot of.
Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness. That's amazing. And quite opposite ends of the spectrum there from a climate positioning.
Yeah. So I have a couple of, you know, Nina told me a lot about you, but tell me, what I'd like to ask is a little bit about you and a little bit about your background. Where'd you grow up? Where are you from? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sure. So I am currently in Chicago, Illinois. So we actually just had your background live on Friday. Lots of snow came down. So I've been here about 30 years now. Born and raised actually in Wisconsin. So just north of the border here in Illinois. Been primarily Midwest growing up, lived in New York for a couple years when I was with L'Oreal. So I do have a little of the East Coast vibe as well. Always been in CPG. I have about 27 years in CPG, various different aspects. So I've been in different categories from household to family planning type categories. But the last, I would say about 19, 20 years now has been focused primarily in beauty landscape. So cosmetics, skincare, hair care type of categories, hair coloring has been more of my focus the last 20 plus years.
What is CPG?
Consumer packaged goods. So the actual products are sold on retail shelves or in the e-com space direct to consumers.
Okay. And does that encompass, like the stuff we commonly see at Sephora and things like that, like skin? Okay.
Absolutely. So think of things that even if you walk a grocery aisle and you're in the personal care beauty space, those types of products would be considered CPG. And honestly, there's different categories within consumer packaged goods. So even Kellogg's and, you know, think from a cereal standpoint, think of a laundry detergent with Tide and P&G. Those are all labeled CPG companies. But again, my focus primarily for 20 plus years, the last 20 years has been in the beauty personal care landscape of CPG.
Okay. Okay. Excellent. And then how did you, there's so many questions around that because there's a lot of dermatologists that have their own skincare line. Mm-hmm. I almost feel like it's very saturated. At one point I wanted my own hair care line. And then as you pointed out, because I work in extreme climates, you know, Miami and Alaska, I worked all the way up north in Alaska too. It wasn't just, you know, Anchorage or anything like that. I worked in Barrow, which is in the Arctic. I was the first dermatologist to work there. They have no trees and it's pitch black actually for 3 months. The sun doesn't rise for 3 months, from like December to February. You just see like a tinge of like a grayish orange at from 1 to 115. That's when people usually do their grocery shopping and go out. But I kind of wanted to, you know, I had all these ideas of things I wanted to create, but do you think it's just too tapped, that industry? And what advice do you give dermatologists, you know, compared to all these other people creating skincare lines, celebrities, you know, lay people creating skincare lines? Is it kind of exhausted? Has it been an exhausted space?
I think beauty in general, I think there's a couple of different dynamics. So beauty in general has been on the rise. So even think about a couple of years ago, right? We all experienced a change in our world with COVID, and we all changed the way we were socializing, our work environments, where we focused our attention, whether it was on ourselves, our family. And we saw some industries really struggle through that moment in time. And in all honesty, beauty was one that succeeded. So I would say it's still a very valid focus, and I expect it to continue to rise. I think you'll see some things like international influence that will start to infiltrate and kind of spark beauty a little bit more. But I also think what the consumers are looking for are going to be more accepted from a derm or an expert voice versus the larger organizations that we're seeing traditionally here in the US market and actually nationally, where it's more marketing derived. I think you will see a very valid space based on what consumers want for a derm voice to come. And that doesn't necessarily have to be in skincare. It can be in other categories within beauty. I think they're looking for a more expert. And when I say expert, I think they're over the celebrity conversation as well. We saw that peak, almost every celebrity, you saw one after another coming out with beauty products.
Oh, yeah.
I think even consumers, what I'm seeing now, they're getting skeptical of the celebrities. And they're seeing that to be part of the marketing arm of companies. So what they're wanting, I think, is going to be more derived from a derm voice. So I think it's a very valid space right now.
Okay. So you think there's still ways that you can be successful having a skincare line, even though there's so many skincare lines, including people who are claiming, you know, they know about skincare, but they're not necessarily, they didn't really study it as a dermatologist did, for example.
Yeah, I do think there's space for it. But I think if we just focus specifically on the skincare category, there almost has to be a revamp of how we speak to a consumer, how we merchandise for a consumer, based on what she's actually kind of telling us. Right? Whether it's through feedback and reviews or her shopping habits and what she's demanding, she's looking for things that are more simplified. They're more pure ingredient based. Something that repairs, doesn't come as a solution to a product, to a problem. She wants to get ahead of a problem even occurring. So all of that, I think, is going to come from, again, a derm voice. I think even she's giving us signs that the way we merchandise in store is very confusing to her. You walk up to a store, it's all brand. It's based on brand, but she's looking for ingredients. She's looking for her skin type, and her skin type could be oily. It could be combination, but it could also be about ethnicity. We don't do skincare by ethnicity, but we do other categories by ethnicity. So there's a lot of things that we could do in the store from a merchandising. You pick up a package and try to read a skincare package. It's very intense. There's a lot of ingredients that to a common consumer may not even understand. So she wants more education on that. And she frankly wants them simplified. I think a good example is we had this trend of like Drunk Elephant, right? You saw all younger consumers driving to Drunk Elephant. It was all the rage. Their products peaked. Just research them online and look at their ingredients. I mean, it goes on three paragraphs, I think. But it was because of the voice of influencers and the marketing that consumers flocked there, but really didn't understand what they were putting on their skin. And then you look at somebody like Paula's Choice that is coming out that is very simplified. They have limited ingredients in their products. They're focused on efficacious ingredients, but there's limited ingredients in there, and they tell the consumer exactly what they are and what they're going to do.
Okay. All right. Excellent. And then a couple things. So piggybacking off of that, are there any voids that you see in the CPG area that you think are untapped or could be explored more, given your extensive experience?
Yeah, I think you're going to see probably a conversation about what we see in other categories and even flipping outside of beauty, but this farm to kind of face conversation, again, going back to some naturality and sustainable type of ingredients. I think you're going to see a conversation rise in that. I think glass skin in skincare will continue, and that's a lot about hydration and that end result of hydrated skin is this glass skin conversation that's influenced by the Asian Pacific market. And I think you're going to continue to see that on the rise. I think you're going to see a rise in conversation around eye. Traditionally, that has kind of, dropped off a little bit when we talk about category segmentation. But I think you're going to see a refocus come now that there are new ingredients on the market. Now there are different technologies on the market. I think you're going to see a refocus in the eye specific. And then I think you're going to see this expansion from a skincare conversation particular to the face, but really focusing down into a whole body conversation, because I think consumers are slowly starting to connect the dot that our skin is our largest organ, and that it goes from head to toe, right? Even though some areas of our skin, because of exposure to, environmental aggressors or what we do with the parts of our body, do have different kind of requirements from a skincare, but I think the conversation and the focus will carry through to a body conversation, not just a face, in the future.
Okay, excellent. And then what about, there's this big movement with Korean and Asian skincare. I kind of am trying to understand what that's about. I haven't been to Korea, but what's different versus like American skincare and, European skincare and skincare made everywhere else?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things that are different. One, I think our consumers here in the US, we are very influenced visually. So when you see Asian Pacific skin, their skin tends to be more of a porcelain, type of visual, right? And so I think there's that visual impact of interest, and we directly correlate that to 100% being these skincare products coming over. So part of it is just what we tend to be influenced by that visual impact. I think part of it is also they're highly focused on sustainability. They are focused on natural ingredients into their products, and they are far advanced versus rest of market, I would say, including your European market, on technology. So that could be biotechnology, AI technology within the skincare category. They're also leveraging a lot of social media to create the buzz and the conversation here into the US. And that's where we're seeing a lot of impact in younger consumers entering the skincare category because they're getting that influence from their social platforms. Which is also kind of peaking that Asian Pacific influence. But really, their products are just, I would say, depending on the product line, they could be anywhere from 2 to 10 years ahead of the U.S. market in just formulations, delivery systems, and technology.
Okay. And then other questions. How did you get into L'Oreal? Like, how did you end up? What was your, how did your career there begin?
I actually began L'Oreal in a sales function. So I had played a bunch of different roles, worked with many different retailers within the L'Oreal company. And then I did some work actually at the headquarters focused from a marketing standpoint on some of our categories. I had stayed with L'Oreal for about 17 years. And really, saw the landscape of a big company who has multiple different types of brands. Their brands can run the gamut from very accessible price point brand all the way up to luxury. I think what we'll see going forward in some of the large organizations, and I won't just use L'Oreal as a prime example. I think there's a couple of different large organizations that we see here globally in the beauty space. But as it relates to skincare and our derm conversation, I think you'll start to see some of those larger companies probably do some acquisitions with some derm brands because they see and they hear the consumer voice. And right now, I think I don't want to say struggling. I think they're a little bit behind the times on trying to get the credibility of a derm voice expert because they have always been such heavily marketing-based organizations. And as I mentioned earlier, the consumers are starting to see through that. So I think the way for them to kind of speed up will. My prediction would be that we'll see some acquisitions that comes with some derm credibility and voice.
Okay, cool. And then that's excellent. And yeah, L'Oreal has a big bond with dermatologists. They're always at our meetings at the American Academy of Dermatology meetings. How can a dermatologist get more involved with L'Oreal? Like, yeah, how can we develop a stronger relationship with L'Oreal besides just, you know, getting to know people at the meetings and
I mean, they do have strong, as you mentioned, relationships. They leverage a lot of that for those expert voices, right? As they're looking to R&D, as they're looking to what might be, some skincare concerns on the rise that they need to get ahead of with consumers and what consumers might be looking for. And again, like I said, you come with the expertise that helps them in their development standpoint. I think the one thing that is probably an opportunity, again, I don't want to just focus particularly from a L'Oreal voice because I do not work with that organization any longer. I've been gone about 3 years. But I would say any large organization, I think the opportunity lies with how do they close the gap of getting that voice that they're leveraging, and listening to and learning from, but getting that voice shifted to the lens of the consumer, getting that voice in front of the consumer, I think is the opportunity. And in some of their lines, in these larger organizations, they do a little bit more, but not so much, I would say, in the accessible brands. Things that your average consumer would see on the shelf at a Walmart or a Target. I think there's that gap that exists there for them to trickle that derm voice and expertise to those accessible brands, because that is what the average consumer is asking for and looking for.
Okay, cool. And then just a question on that. How, if you're a brand, how do you even get a space featured in like a Target, CVS, or like a Whole Foods, for example, or a Sephora? I'm always curious, how are they, how do they choose which brands to bring in? How do you do that? I've heard different things that sometimes companies buy a space do they reach out to companies and say, hey, we want you to have a shelf here? What is the process, just as someone that doesn't know, to actually get featured in a store that there's a lot of traffic in?
Yeah, I think the process has evolved over the years. You had referenced a bias space conversation, which I think, you know, is kind of one of those borderline, maybe happen in certain retailers and maybe a myth of how brands came to market. But there has been an evolution of how you get to the merchandising shelf. And currently, a lot of retailers are looking, one, I would say they're listening to their customers and they're listening to the consumers on what they want. So they are more open to the larger organizations maybe dominating that shelf space with their brand. They're looking for things that the consumer might have new interest in, or a new ingredient, a new approach to skincare and answering a skincare problem. But again, they're leading that conversation based on information provided from their direct customers or consumers. Then I would say they would also bring into their assessment of awareness in the market, right? So whether that is awareness from traditional marketing, are they leveraging influencers? How many followers do they have on Instagram? What is that awareness and conversation? Because again, to bring inventory in is a financial impact to a retailer, but they want to make sure that is actually going to sell out to kind of balance that, right? Just from P&L and financial perspective and inventory management. So they're going to look for what the consumer wants. They're going to look for, is there a pull through on shelf? And every retailer technically does have some different consumers that shop their store. So does my consumer lean towards more of a luxury brand because maybe their share of wallet is a little bit larger? Or are they more of an accessible brand? Do I have duplication on my shelf? So there are multiple layers of how to get into a retailer. Unfortunately, it's not so cut and dry. I have a great product. I want to be on your shelf. And every retailer is a bit different. First, I would say if you're starting a brand, to evaluate your own brand strategy, right? You're going to naturally do that on a brand when you think about who's my consumer I'm targeting. You know, is there gender? Is there ethnicity? What category do I want to play in? There's all those things you're going to go through from a brand strategy and a marketing strategy, but you also have to think about your retailer strategy, and that will play into how to get into a retailer as well. So I know there's, you know, big ambitions when you start a brand, there's lots of excitement. You'll take anybody who gives you a yes. But truly, the long-term success is going to come with being on the right shelf in the right stores to meet those consumer needs. So if you're getting into, Walmart, just to get into a Walmart, but really your brand is a brand that comes with more ingredients or technology that really would connect more with a savvy skincare consumer. Maybe it has too much technology that's just a little bit elevated from your average consumer's education currently in the market. Then you have to get into those different, maybe a department store, maybe a derm store, right? A spa, a med spa, Ulta, Sephora, right? So I think it's also about retail strategy of driving that success.
Okay, cool. Yeah, excellent. And what are the steps if you want to create, let's say, a line? You know, I'm sure a lot of dermatologists have this idea, non-dermatologists as well. What do you typically start doing? Do you start going out interviewing cosmetic chemists? What more or less would you suggest is people's budget? if they had this dream of doing this, what's a reasonable budget to have, you know, in mind for this and time frame? Like, how long would it take? You know, I've heard everything from 3 years, which just seems impossible to me. And then I've heard, you know, things like $10,000 is more or less to $50,000. And I've even heard, you know, is it Unilever? I know a dermatologist that partnered with Unilever for creating something for the armpit and some sort of deodorant that, you know, doesn't make you smell. I mean, I've heard all kinds of things. I think people are wanting like a ballpark figure of what it takes to start, you know, your own line.
Ooh, loaded question. There's a lot there to unpackage. Yeah. But I would say starting your own brand or your line, my recommendation would be homework. Start with the homework. Look at the category, look at the industry trends, look at the consumer. What's the consumer voice saying right now? What is she ready for? Like I said, we had a little bit of that conversation earlier about the Asian Pacific market, and there are tons of ingredients and tons of technologically advanced products. But in the US consumer, she's not ready for that all yet. She's not as advanced in that education level. So I would say look there, right? Start to do homework. I would also look at gaps. And you'll find that by studying the actual category in the shelves here in the US. Go walk stores, see what the brands have to offer. What's the next ingredient conversation happening? How are they merchandised? Because you want to close a gap, a need gap for a customer that has a problem or a concern on the rise. And you're going to learn that as well from her voice and her conversation. And I think that will drive you into spurring that idea, right? What is my product going to be? What is my point of difference going to be? And then, like you said, it's all the roll up the sleeve time. I have to roll up my sleeves. Now I have to go talk to chemists. I have to find an ingredient manufacturer, right, to source from. Do I want natural ingredients? Do I want synthetic ingredients? Do I want a blend? How will that formulation come to rise? And then you move forward into all of the details around marketing. What's my packaging? What's my messaging? How am I going to approach the conversation? How am I going to educate my consumers? And then ultimately, where do I want to be? Reflecting back on the retailer strategy conversation, how do I know where I want to now take my conversation that my consumers can best find me? And I can solve their problem or concern. So many, many steps. Like you said, it does take some time. You know, again, it depends on what your ingredients are, how fast you can source those ingredients, how fast you get through that ideation moment of your marketing, your packaging, to come to actual production. And that's going to be fueled by budgeting as well. How much can you produce based on demand? Do I start in an e-commerce space or am I headed to retail conversations? Even when you start the retail conversations, that can be a journey. So they work out 9 months to a year in advance sometimes in US specific to skincare. So they're looking for new brands a year before it's ever going to hit the shelf. So you got to get ahead of that and keep that retailer timing in perspective when you build your plan. So it can honestly go anywhere from 3 to 5 years, sometimes a little bit longer, depending on, again, that budgeting. And your budgeting is really going to vary based on an individual, right? Am I going to start small? Am I going to start an e-commerce? Direct consumer? Am I going to try the avenue of a retailer, which is going to increase your budget based on production, demand, marketing needs, and then just costs associated with doing business with a retailer? What I would recommend is that you had referenced Unilever. So some of these larger corporations do have programs where it's almost like a Shark Tank, right? Where you can kind of pitch ideas, right? And they have some investment centers in these large corporations that could help your journey if you are awarded. I will also share that retailers have this type of program as well. Ulta has a big one. So again, if you have this idea and you're at a certain moment in time, and it is, again, a strong point of difference, we're really answering a consumer need that's on the horizon, you've kind of done all that homework and budgeting, I would recommend either of those two avenues to explore for potential additional funding and support of getting to market.
Okay, that's a great idea. I didn't know that they had that. I'm actually in Unilever's Black Book. Just a couple weeks ago, I did a meeting with them in Europe. It was actually a virtual meeting, but as a resource, as just a resource dermatologist. And I didn't know that they had that. One dermatologist, she used a contact. We actually went to Tanzania together in a dermatology conference through AAD, and then we did a hike through Kilimanjaro together. And she was telling me about it. But yeah, I mean, it's really blown up for her. One other topic I wanted to explore is, do you think retail shopping for skincare in person is kind of dying out or dying as opposed to buying stuff online? You know, with the closure of a lot of retail stores, like lots of Macy's, JCPenney's, Nordstrom's, are people just not, you know, going outside, walking, seeing what's around? You know, I used to go to Sephora a lot and just check out what brands they had when I was growing up. Now I don't think I've been to a store in years, you know, even in person. And a lot of patients also are not necessarily going to a dermatologist's office or in person to buy their skincare products. They'll like to know what you recommend, but they'll often go home. And I heard this from a dermatologist yesterday, actually. I went to Tor's office just to get ideas. And they'll take a picture of what you're recommending in the office, and they'll go home and buy it online. You know, so it's even hard to sell things in the office. And he actually does private labeling only. That's all he does because he finds it sells better. But what are your thoughts on that? Buying online and selling, you know, physically in person versus selling online. You know, I don't actually sell any products in person because I don't have a lot of space in my office. Real estate's very expensive here in Miami. And I don't want to keep track of inventory. So I'll have links on certain websites that I'm on. I'm also an influencer, where I have even discount codes for people. They could, you know, get 10% off or whatever. And it just kind of feels cleaner that way. You know, I don't have to store anything. I'm not stocking up, you know, taking up extra space in my office. And then I don't have to worry about someone just not buying something in the office and leaving and buying it elsewhere. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah,
what are you stuck with the dollars of inventory?
Exactly. Which are not cheap. Yeah. It's a lot. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So look, I think we have to be honest with how consumers are shopping.
Yeah.
In any category, we all do it. I think that moment in time with COVID spurred it a little bit more. But yes, we are going to look at e-commerce because it's fast, it's easy. I think of Amazon as the new Google because anytime, that's how consumers are using it, honestly. When they want to research a product, they're no longer going in Google. They're going in Amazon, seeing if they have it, and then they're reading the information there. Or even if they're in a store in front of that shelf or a derm office looking at the product, they're going to look at an e-commerce space, primarily in Amazon. You see a lot of retailers now focusing in their e-commerce space and how do I compete against larger e-commerce-based organizations like an Amazon. I don't think we're going to see that go away, in all honesty. I think it's still going to see that grow a little bit. And it's just going to add more competition to traditional retailers on how they have to do business. I think we also have had a couple years, again, whether it's inflation or different economic concerns that individuals have had about maybe their disposable income and where they want to use that, lended them to be very price savvy. And frankly, by nature, once we've done it for the last couple of years, even if we have a shift in economics or our individual positioning, it doesn't mean that we're just going to go back to kind of fun spending habits, because we've created a new habit of being savvy and it's so easy for us, right? It almost takes no time. So I think you're always going to continue now to see a focus on price sensitivity in the market. I think from traditional brick and mortar shopping, particular to skincare, I think one, the retailer needs to address this, because you get to a skincare shelf, we kind of hit on this topic earlier, is very overwhelming. There are so many products, there's small products, there's by brand, they can't navigate, you know, maybe they're looking for an ingredient, but everything's merchandised by brand. You pick up a box and it's like telling a story in really tiny letters, you can't even read it. So it's very confusing. And any consumer will tell you the merchandising in store is very consuming. And then you have them at the shelf for 3 seconds. So what are they going to do? They're going to do their research really quick in the Amazon Google world. And if they find a different price, they're going to just buy it and click it and it's easier. So I think in order to do some retainment there, retailers and brands alike need to think of how we merchandise and how that space shows up for a consumer, because she has been vocal for years on the confusion she experiences. In addition, particular to skincare consumers, because there is this rapid increase, there's a lot of change happening in skincare, again, of technology, ingredients, a derm voice, a celebrity pops up with a new product. She loves to have those conversations. So she's going to look for beauty experts or derm experts. So she's going to talk to her beauty counter at Nordstrom's, Neiman's, at an Ulta, at a Sephora. Blue Mercury is rapidly increasing, and it's because they have that connection to consumers. And somebody is there to have the conversation and explain to them. We don't do a good job explaining what the ingredients are or what they do. We just create the buzz of the ingredients is what's happening in the marketplace right now. So she is looking for that. So I don't think you'll see traditional brick and mortar go away. I think there may be more shift to certain types of retailers that maybe have a little bit more educational resourcing or derm or beauty experts on site versus maybe just a replenishment purchase if she likes her favorite, you know, Cetaphil cleanser and grabs it at a Walmart.
Okay, excellent. And another thing that I've just seen in my career, I like traveling a lot. And sometimes, you know, I'll take a tour or talk to some of the local people and I'll find, let's say, a plant that has special healing properties. And I'm like, well, why isn't this in skincare? Like, why didn't we just put this in petroleum jelly and, you know, market it, you know, in Alaska, like I was talking about, because I really love Alaska, you can tell. There's a huge native population, you know, there's, we call it Inuit, Eskimo is not the appropriate term, but Inuit is, you know, the official term. And then they have different tribes and they have lots of, I wouldn't say lots of plants because actually up north there are no plants, but kind of in the middle part, there's something called stinkweed and people use like a salve and it'll help heal the skin, which of course gets very damaged from the extreme weather. And to the point where once I went to see a patient and his skin looked purple. Mm-hmm. When he did a skin check, his skin was purple like a grape, you know, and I just wonder, you know, have you come across a lot of those ingredients? How do we get the word out of these ingredients that are used for healing and could be used, you know, to their potential to help other people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great question. I think one, that's why we're seeing kind of the influence of Asian Pacific market products coming here to the U.S. and being so accepted by U.S. consumers, because they're really good at that. They're really good at looking at nature and naturality of plant-based healing. And as you mentioned, it is happening in other parts of the world. What I think we have to do, and you referenced this, is that educational piece, right? Get consumers comfortable that this plant is going to fix my skincare concern. Because for so long, we've been focused on chemically derived or synthetic conversation. And, you know, the more scientific the ingredient sounds, the more they believe it's the credible approach to cure their skincare condition. So I think it's partly education. I think the other thing is being proactive. Right now, our skincare conversations and consumers act in a reactive base. Like, oh, I have this problem, now I gotta go solve for it. When a lot of skincare, and you probably know this best from your expertise, is if you take care of your skin, the problem won't occur. And some of that can be done from naturally sourced type of ingredients or plant-based ingredients, because they do just have this either natural healing power, or they have a balancing power to your own microbiome. So I think a lot of it is also education and getting them comfortable with the fact that these ingredients, even though they're plant-based, are just as powerful as what we maybe derive in R&D or manufacturing facilities. The one thing I would tell just an average consumer, though, is just because, you know, there's also been this conversation about clean and natural, and we haven't really had any regulations until recently in the U.S. when FDA did the MOCRA regulations that are coming out. So now we have to be more sensitive and forthright with our ingredients for the consumers to kind of understand exactly what's in it. But I would just caution a consumer anytime they use a product to do a test area, whether it's a synthetic or a manufactured type of ingredient or a natural ingredient, because if you have an allergen to something plant-based or something environmental, if it comes in the form of skincare, you're probably still going to have a similar allergic reaction, right? So it may say natural and it is purely natural, but just know your own skin and knowing your own body, just like you would with, frankly, any other organ, right? You're going to respond to what your body's telling you. And I would just say do the same in skincare.
Okay, excellent. And then any, so I know you mentioned that you were with CBP and L'Oreal for many years. What would you say that you focused mostly on, consulting and kind of individual personalized or business to business consulting now, given all these years of experience that you have under your belt?
Yeah, more of a business to business consulting. As you can see through our conversations, I am highly focused on what the consumer voice is saying throughout all of beauty. I watch that very, very closely, because when I have the conversations with a business to business entity, again, I am a firm believer that everything starts with the consumer. And what she's seeing, and we have to be very mindful of that in everything that we do, because that creates the long-term success. So yes, and more of a business-to-business conversation, but very in tune with the consumer, because as I mentioned, I believe that is the pivotal starting point of any aspect of beauty business. And really, the beauty business is change every single day, and that can be good. But you have to have your head on the swivel, because at any given moment, the consumer's voice is very loud and she's going to change her direction. So that's why I always start with her voice first.
Okay, excellent. That's like, for me, the patient's voice, you know, what
exactly.
Patient, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cool. I think that's it. Any other questions or parting thoughts?
No, I think first, thank you. Thank you for having me today. It was a lovely conversation. I think just in general, always for consumers, it surprises me sometimes the neglect and the forgetfulness of how important our skin is and that it is the largest organ. And it's like, just listen to your skin. Just like, as I mentioned a couple of minutes ago, you listen to anything else in your body, you know, and then just have those conversations. So I think that would be my only parting thought. I think in beauty, from a parting thought on that is we saw over the last couple of years, and you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation was something you wanted to do. The last couple of years, you saw this, again, rapid increase in skincare. We're going to keep seeing that skincare started to outpace things like cosmetics. My prediction is hair care is going to be the next skincare. And you're already slowly starting to see it, even from a derm perspective, where it's a lot about scalp care happening now in hair care. And I think you're going to see that rapidly increase, that those skincare conversations, concerns, consumers are going to start to think of that in the way of hair care. And that is going to be the next really rapidly growing category in beauty.
All right. Excellent. Thank you so much. Thanks for all your wisdom and thanks for being part of the show. And we'll keep in touch. I'm sure this won't be the last time we speak. And have a great rest of your weekend.
Yeah, you as well. Take care. Thank you. Bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.